Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yep.
And NPR.
Hi there.
We're going to start today's program with a fellow named Robert.
Is it Epstein or Epstein?
Just think Einstein with an Ep.
Okay.
That would make it Epstein, I guess.
That's right.
And where are we reaching you right now?
I am in the San Diego area.
Robert Epstein is a psychologist.
Former editor-in-chief of Psychology Today magazine.
He's written a ton of books on relationships and love, and he also happens to be one of the world's leading researchers in computer-human interactions. Like artificial intelligence, basically.
That is correct, yes.
There may be trouble ahead.
So, when did you decide to go onto the computer to get a date?
2006, maybe. Why do you ask?
Oh, no reason.
No, well,
what happened? You had gotten divorced.
Yeah, I was single at the time. Yeah, I was divorced.
And you decided that you'd try love in all the right places, or what?
Oh, sure. Well, online dating, everyone was doing it. My cousin actually convinced me to try it. So I did. And I went online, and I looked at photos, and I looked at profiles, and I communicated with various people who were willing to talk to me. And one of the women I was communicating with lived in Southern California, where I do. So I thought, that's great, because, you know, you want someone to be nearby.
Right.
And she had a very attractive photo online. And her English was poor, which at first bothered me. And then she said, well, she's not really in California. She's really in Russia.
Oh.
But all four of my grandparents came from Russia. So I thought, well, I'll go with it. So I continued to write to her.
Hi, sweet Svetlana. It's very warm here now, and I've been doing a lot of swimming. I've also been writing, doing computer programming.
She wrote back to me in very poor English.
Hello, dear Robert. Dear mine, I have received your letter. I am very happy.
I remember that she liked to walk in parks.
Went on walk with the girlfriend, and we went and walked in parks.
And telling me about her family and her mom.
My mom asked me about you today, and we spoke much and long time.
They lived in a small apartment. I knew where in Russia they lived.
Yours, Svetlana.
Felt like we were bonding for sure.
Hello. I might be able to come to Moscow on Sunday, April 15th, departing Thursday, April 19th. With love, Robert.
Oh, so it was getting serious.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Wow.
Then what happened?
Well, 2 months passed and I began to feel uncomfortable. Something wasn't right.
Hello, my dear.
There were no phone calls.
Dear mine, I am very happy.
At some point, I began to suggest a phone call, but there weren't any. But the main problem was, I would say something like,
did you get my letter about me coming to Moscow in April?
Or tell me more about this friend of yours that you mentioned. And she did not.
Dear mine, I am very glad to your letter.
She did not. She was still replying with fairly long emails.
I'm fine. Weather in my city, very bad.
But they were kind of rambling in general.
I think of you always much, and I very much want to see more likely you.
I already gave you some dates of our visit to Moscow, my love. What do you think about that?
Then, at some point, a little bell went off in my head, finally, and I started to send some emails, which, let's say, included random alphabet letters.
Wait a second. So you say, what are you wearing tonight? Are you wearing a DBGGGGLP?
Exactly. And it didn't make any difference.
Hello, dear Robert. Your letters do me very happy when I open a letterbox.
And that's when I realized Ivana was not a person. Ivana was a computer program. I had been had.
Wow. So what did you think?
I felt like a fool. I felt like an incredible fool, especially given my background.
Yeah.
That I had been fooled that long. Now, I can tell you, now this is something I've never made public about the other example.
Robert went on to tell us that not long after that first incident, he was corresponding with someone.
With a woman, I thought.
Who also turned out to be a robot. And he discovered it this time because...
The programmer contacted me from the UK and said, I know who you are. You have not been communicating with a person. You've been communicating with a chatbot.
You've been now undressed twice by robots.
So to speak.
Well, and maybe more than twice.
Well, how common do you think this is? Do you think that Match.com and all those places are like swarming with these bots?
You know, I bet you they are.
Stop it.
That's what you have to understand. There are hundreds of these things out there. There might be thousands.
You're amazing.
That's what's coming.
What sign are you? I told my girlfriends all about you.
So in a world like this,
you're wonderful.
We are surrounded by artificial life forms.
What do you look like?
Things can get a little confusing. And in fact, we're going to do a whole show about that confusion, about the sometimes peculiar,
sometimes strange
things that can happen when humans and machines collide.
Collide, but don't quite know who's on what side of the road.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I'm Jad Abumrad. That was good. Just go with it.
Okay, I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
And we're talking to machines.
You are so special.
Send me your credit card info.
I love peppermint.
To start things off, let's introduce you to the person who really hooked us on this whole idea of human-robot chit-chat.
My name is Brian Christian.
He's a writer. Are you Christian?
Religiously?
No.
Man,
that's not at all related to anything.
What's wrong with you?
It's his name. What's important is that he wrote a book.
It's called The Most Human Human.
Which is all about the confusing things that can happen when people and machines interact.
This is such a curious thing to get.
Yeah, how did you get into this?
I played with MS-DOS intently when I was a child.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
DOS is kind of the early version of Windows.
I was programming these sort of rudimentary maze games.
Like a cursor going through a maze?
Yeah, basically.
Did this by any chance mean you did not develop best friends?
A lot of my best friends were also into that, yeah.
Wow.
We were not the coolest, but we had a lot of fun.
So there you are, and you just had a... You just had a talent for this?
I don't know what it was. I mean, I was just, there was something I think fascinating to me that you could take a process that you knew how to do, but in breaking it down to steps that were that explicit, mm-hmm. you often learned something about how the process actually works. Hmm. For me, programming is surprisingly linked to introspection.
How exactly?
Well, you know, if a computer were a person, you can imagine someone sitting in your living room and you say, you know, can you hand me that book? And it would say, no, I can't do that because there's a coffee cup on it. And you say, okay, well, pick up the coffee cup and hand me the book. And it says, well, I can't do that because now I'm holding the cup. And you say, okay, put down the cup, then pick up the book.
And what you quickly learn, says Brian, is that even really simple human behaviors are made up of 1,000 subroutines. I mean, if you really think about it, the book task requires knowing what is a book.
You have to learn about elbows and wrists.
How to grab something.
What is a book?
I already said that.
Oh.
You need to know about gravity.
If it's a machine, you have to teach it.
Physics.
Everything in the world in order for it to just pick up a spoon.
Or a book.
I knew that.
So now, think of that Svetlana bot earlier, okay? Trying to make something that could actually mimic human conversation, kind of, sort of.
Mm.
Imagine all the stuff you'd have to throw into that. Okay, English, grammar.
Syntax, context.
Tone.
Mood.
Sarcasm.
Irony.
Adverbs. Turn-taking.
Well, it's not actually as impossible as you'd imagine. This is kind of startling. If you go back to the very early days of software programming in the mid-60s.
1964, 1965.
This was actually done with a little program
called ELIZA, and it was developed by Joseph Weizenbaum at MIT.
But in Weizenbaum's case, his model was not a Russian hottie. Instead, it was a,
non-directive Rogerian therapist.
The what therapist?
It's a particular school of therapy
The kind where the therapist basically mirrors
what you're saying.
This is Sherry Turkle. She's an anthropologist
at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
And she worked with Joe Weizenbaum, or is it Weizenbaum? It's Weizenbaum, at MIT.
So if you say, you know, I'm
feeling depressed.
The therapist says,
I'm sorry to hear you're feeling depressed.
Tell me more.
Joseph Weizenbaum decides, you know, I think that's an easy enough type of conversation that I can program that into my computer.
And so he writes up a simple little program.
Just about 100 lines of code.
Which does sort of what your therapist does.
Where it looks for a keyword in what you're saying.
As in, I'm feeling depressed. Keyword, depressed.
Latches onto it and then basically flips it back to you.
I'm sorry to hear that you're feeling,
keyword,
depressed.
Right.
It's basically a program that inverts your words and it's a language game.
So here's what he did. He put a computer on a desk running this little program, and he invited people to sit down and talk to it. They'd write in something, and it would spit back the keyword, and then you would then repeat, and it would go on and on. You wouldn't think this would be very interesting, right?
Nope.
But he found that his students, one who knew that the program didn't know or understand, who had helped him write the program, sophisticated students, nevertheless, wanted to be alone with it.
Wow, they actually helped write the program.
Yes.
I can read you, if you like, one of the conversations.
Yes, please.
This is an actual transcript between Eliza and a young woman.
Yeah, men are all alike. In what way? They're always bugging us about something or other.
Can you think of a specific example?
Well, my boyfriend made me come here.
Your boyfriend made you come here.
He says I'm depressed much of the time.
I'm so sorry to hear you are depressed.
It's true.
I'm unhappy.
Do you think coming here will help you not to be unhappy?
Oh, I need some help. That much seems certain.
What would it mean to you if you got some help?
Perhaps I could learn to get along with my mother.
Tell me more about your family.
Wow.
And so it's this...
That could go on for hours.
Well, and in fact, it did.
My mother takes care of me.
Who else in your family takes care of you?
My father.
Your father.
You're like my father in some ways.
What resemblance do you see?
Well, you're not very aggressive.
What makes you think I'm not very aggressive?
You don't argue with me.
Why do you think I don't argue with you?
You are afraid of me?
Wait a second.
Please you to believe that
Is the woman in this transcript messing around, or is she really pouring her heart out?
We know that this is a woman who works for Joe Weizenbaum. She's sitting in the office, and she just can't stop talking to it. That's all we know.
What else comes to mind when you think of your father?
Bullies.
And Weizenbaum is watching all this.
And he first thought it was funny, and then he didn't think it was funny because they were actually having conversations with it.
One day he comes into the office and
his secretary
is on the computer divulging her life story to it.
According to Weizenbaum, she even told him to please leave the room so she could be alone with it.
And talk to it. And he was very upset. Nevertheless,
when word about Eliza got out,
the medical community sort of latches onto it.
Really?
And says, oh, this is going to be the next revolution in therapy.
Something new and promising in the field of psychotherapy.
This is from a newscast around that time.
Therapists in, like, phone booths in cities, and you're going to walk in and put a quarter in the slot and have, you know, half an hour of therapy with this automatic program.
Computer time can be rented for $5 an hour, and there's every reason to suspect that it will go down significantly.
People really thought that they were going to replace therapists with computers?
Absolutely.
Really?
They did.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it was just this really appalling moment for Weizenbaum of there's something, the genie is out of the bottle maybe in a bad way. And he does this 180 of his entire career. So he pulls the plug on the program, he cuts the funding, and he goes from being one of the main advocates for artificial intelligence to basically committing the rest of his career to fighting against artificial intelligence.
This is Joseph Weizenbaum interviewed in German just before he died in 2008. It was on the German documentary Plug and Pray.
Und mein Kerneinwand ist,
my main objection, he says,
wenn das Ding
if
sagt,
the thing says I understand, that if somebody typed in something and the machine says, I understand,
da ist doch niemand da.
There's no one there.
Also ist es doch eine Lüge.
So it's a lie.
Nicht? Und, ich kann mir nicht vorstellen,
and I can't imagine that people who are emotionally imbalanced could be effectively treated by systematically lying to them.
Anlügt.
I must say that my reaction to the Eliza program at the time was to try to reassure him. At the time, what I thought people were doing was using it as a kind of interactive diary, knowing that it was a machine but using it as an occasion to breathe life into it in order to get their feelings out.
I think she's right to have said that to him.
You do?
Yeah, because I mean, he says it's a lie.
Well, it is a lie.
I mean, how is it a lie?
Well, because a machine can't love anything.
Yes, and if you are a sensible human being, you know that.
Yeah,
and it's sitting right there on the desk. It's not pretending.
Well, these are sensible human beings that were already a little bit seduced. Matt, just go forward 100 years. Imagine a machine that is very sophisticated, very fluent, very convincingly human.
You're talking about Blade Runner, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. At that point, I think I would require some kind of label to remind me that this is a thing. It's not a being. It's just a thing.
Okay, but if here's something to think about. If the machines get to that point, which is a big if, where you'd want to label them,
yeah.
Well, you're going to need a way to know when they've crossed that line and become
mindful.
Yeah, yeah. So I should back up for a sec and say that in 1950, they're just starting to develop the computer, and they're already asking these philosophical questions, like, can these machines think? You know, will we someday be able to make a machine that could think? And if we did, how would we know? And so a British mathematician named Alan Turing
proposed a simple thought experiment. Here's how we'll know when the machines make it across the line. Get a person, sit him down at a computer, have him start a conversation in text.
You know, hi, how are you? Enter. Good pops up on the screen.
Sort of like internet chat.
Yep.
So after that first conversation, have him do it again and then again. You know, hi, hello, how are you, etc.
Back and forth.
Then again.
Right.
Over and over. But here's the catch.
Half of these conversations will be with real people. Half will be with these computer programs that are basically impersonating people.
And the person in the seat, the human, has to judge which of the conversations were with people and which were with humans. Turing's idea was that if those computer fakes could fool the human judge a certain percentage of the time.
Turing's magic threshold was 30%.
Then at that point,
we can basically consider machines intelligent.
Because, you know, if you can't tell the machine isn't human, then you can't say it's not intelligent.
Yeah, that's basically, yeah.
He said 30% of the time? Why?
Yeah, Turing.
Because the natural number to me would be half, you know. 51% would seem to be like the ka-ching moment.
Right.
30%, I don't know.
Well, 51% is actually a horrifying number in the context of the Turing test, because you've got these two conversations and you're trying to decide which is the real person. So if the computer were indistinguishable, that would be 50%. You know, the judge is doing no better than chance. So if a computer hits 51%,
yeah,
that means they've out-humaned the human.
Oh yeah, that is horrifying. Now, something to keep in mind. When Turing thought this whole thing up,
the technology was so new.
Computers barely existed.
That it was sort of a leap of imagination, really.
But no longer. Robert, bring it.
Can you give me like some kind of excitement music here?
Absolutely.
Good. Because every year, the greatest technologist on the planet.
My name's Mo on Ember.
Hi, I'm Roland Carpenter.
Meet in a small room with folding chairs.
Yeah, I develop in Java. This
and put Alan Turing's question to the ultimate test.
Really, it's just a couple dudes, you know, who haven't seen the sun in 10 years in a room. But we do now have this thing called the Loebner Prize, which is essentially a yearly actual Turing test.
Each judge on our judges' table is going to be communicating with two entities, one human and one program.
The way the stage is set up is you've got the judges at a table on the left on laptops,
uh-huh.
Then a bunch of giant server-looking machines in the middle that the programmers are fiddling with. And then there's a curtain on the right-hand side, and we're behind the curtain.
Brian actually participated in the 2009 Loebner Prize competition, but not as a programmer, as one of the four, quote, Confederates.
The Confederates are the real people that the judges are talking to.
Because remember, half the conversations that judges have are with people, half are with computers. Now, Brian decided to participate that year because the year before,
2008, the top program managed to fool 25% of the judging panel.
Pretty close to Turing's number.
Exactly. One vote away. And so I felt, to some extent, how can I get involved on behalf of humanity? How can I sort of take a stand?
That's a modest position for you.
All right, machines, please hold your places. And now representing all humans, Brian Christian.
Now, in terms of what Brian is up against, the computer programs have a variety of different strategies. For example, there was one program Brian's year that would do kind of a double fake out,
uh-huh.
where it would pretend not to be a person, but a
person who is sarcastically pretending to be a robot.
Oh.
People would ask it a simple question, and it would say, I don't have enough RAM to answer that question, smiley face. And everyone would be like, oh, this is such a wise guy, ha ha ha.
I want to tell you now about one particular bot that competed Brian's year.
Hi, I'm Rollo Carpenter.
That's the guy who made it.
My program is called Cleverbot.
And that's the bot. This is a program that employs a very spooky, is spooky the right word? A very spooky strategy.
You may be surprised to hear that despite the fact that it's called Cleverbot, it states that it is a bot, it states that it is never a human right there in front of them. Despite those facts, I receive several emails a day from people who believe that actually they are being connected to humans.
Oh, like they think they've been tricked.
Yes, tricked into coming to a site that claims to be a bot when in fact they're talking to humans. That no program could possibly respond in this way. And there is a certain element of truth in that.
To explain, Rollo Carpenter, like Brian, was one of those kids who was completely obsessed by computers.
I was indeed a computery kid.
And when he was just a teenager,
age about 16 or so,
wrote his first chatbot.
I created a program that talked to me.
No kidding.
Yes. You typed in something and it would say something back.
Though at that time, the responses were essentially
pre-programmed
and really simple, kind of like Eliza. But
one evening, I think it was.
Fast forward many years, he is in his apartment, and one night, he says,
A switch suddenly flipped in my mind. And I suddenly saw how to make the machine learn.
On its own. What if, he thought, what if it just started at zero, like a little baby, and it would grow in these discrete little increments every time you talk to it?
Right. Basically, the first thing that was said to that program that I created the first version of that night was said back by it.
Meaning, if he said to it hello, it now knew one thing, the word hello, so it would say hello back.
The second thing it said was a choice of the first two things said to it.
So if the second thing you said was, how are you doing, it now knew two things, the word hello and the phrase, how are you doing? So it could either say hello back again or how are you doing?
The third thing it said was a choice of the first three things and so on, ad infinitum. Well, not quite ad infinitum, but between 1988 and 1997, a few thousand conversations took place between myself and it and a few of my friends and it.
He and his friends would sit there and type things to it as a way of teaching it new things. But it was just them, so it was slow going.
So it languished for quite a long time. But then I started working with the internet, put it online.
Where anyone could talk to it.
Within the next 10 years, it had learned something like 5 million lines of conversation. Now, it is frequently handling around 200,000 requests an hour. And it's talking to more than 3 million people a month.
3 million conversations a month. And after each one, Cleverbot knows a little bit more than it did before. And every time you say something to it, like, hey, Cleverbot, why am I so sad?
It is accessing the conversations that millions of people have had in the past.
Asking itself,
what is the best overlap? Where is the best correlation?
How do people usually answer this question, why am I so sad?
That's right.
And then a response. Cleverbot answers, just because. All right, well, why, there must be a reason why I'm so sad. Because you've been sitting in the same place for too long. Is that, who's saying that exactly? Where does that response come from?
And the answer is, it is one human being at some point in the past having said that.
So that is one moment of human conversation from one person.
Yes.
So it's like I'm talking to a ghost.
You are talking to, its intelligence, if you like, is borrowed from millions of people in the past. A little bit of their conversational knowledge, their conversational intelligence, goes into forming your reply.
Now, what's interesting, says Rollo, is that when you start a conversation with Cleverbot, it doesn't really have a personality, or no one personality.
Cleverbot is everything to everyone.
It's just this big hive, really. But as you keep talking to it, and it's sort of pulling forward from the hive these little ghost fragments of past conversations, stitching them together, a form does kind of emerge.
It reflects the person that is speaking to. It becomes somewhat like that person.
Someone familiar.
Already, people have very emotional conversations with it. People have complete arguments with it. And, of course, they try to get it into bed.
By talking dirty to it?
Yeah. Wow. One thing I can tell you is that I have seen a single person, a teenage girl, speaking for 11 hours with just three 15-minute breaks.
Whoa. About what?
Everything. The day will come not too far down the road where Cleverbot becomes so interesting to talk to that people will be talking to it all day, every day.
But we're not there yet. Because the same thing that makes Cleverbot so interesting to talk to also can make it kind of ridiculous. For example, in our interview with Brian, he was the first person to turn us on to this program. As we were talking, Soren just sort of suggested, well, why don't we just try it right now?
You want to try it? You want to talk? You want to say to Cleverbot, I feel blue?
Sure, yeah. Are you pulling Cleverbot up? Is it just cleverbot.org or something?
.com. I feel blue.
Can you say I feel blue because an asteroid hit my house this morning?
So this is, you've hit on a perfect strategy of dealing with these bots.
Absurdity?
Yes. Well, it basically saying something that has never been said before to Cleverbot. So it's likely that no one has ever claimed an asteroid hit their house. It's weird enough that it may not be in the database.
Okay.
All right. Let's see what it says. An asteroid hit my house this morning. And Cleverbot says, I woke up at 1 p.m. this afternoon.
Well, there we go. It's not quite so clever.
See, you don't have to worry yet, Krowich. In fact, when I went online to YouTube and watched the Loebner competition that Brian attended, turns out none of the computers fooled the judges at all.
None any.
Well, I don't know if none, but they did really badly.
There were no ambiguities between the programs and computers.
For me, one of the strange takeaways of thinking so much about artificial intelligence is this feeling of how complex it is to sit across a table from someone and communicate with body language and tone and, you know, rhythm and all of these things. What happens when those conversations are working out well is that we're willing to move the conversation in ways that allows us to be sort of perpetually startling to one another.
That's a good word, startling.
Yeah. You learn someone through these small surprises.
Thanks to Brian Christian. His excellent book, which inspired this hour, is called The Most Human Human. Go to radiolab.org for more info. Thanks also to our actors, Sarah Thayer, Andy Richter, and Susan Blackwell.
Hi, this is Brian Christian. Radiolab is funded.
Hello, I'm a machine. Radiolab is funded, in part, by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Hello, this is Sherry Turkle. Radiolab is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR.
Bye-bye.